Intellectual Muscle, University Dialogues for Vancouver 2010. Attaining Spiritual Heights. This is the big question relating to the way in which humanity is like the Olympians, and is posed by Dr. Joe Valadium, Chair of the Department of Religious Studies and the Center for Christianity and Culture at the University of Prince Edward Island.
As recounted by author Maria Coffey, when asked why she spent leisurely Sunday afternoons climbing frozen waterfalls without the aid of ropes or harnesses, the extreme athlete she was interviewing responded, "For emotion, for attention, sometimes for excitement and money and fame, but mostly it's about attaining spiritual heights." I've increasingly become intrigued. Well, actually, I've become obsessed by these anecdotes, not because they're rare, but precisely because they're so commonplace, even in our secular society. It's not just these extreme athletes, these people who seemingly push beyond the limits of human physical capacity on mountaintops without supplemental oxygen, or in the middle of frozen waterfalls without ropes or harnesses, or in marathons performed in searing deserts and frozen Antarctic tundras. No, it's not just these people who frequently speak of some sort, some version of transcendence. In many ways, most of us do. One doesn't have to read Plato to know that many people have children because of their need, sometimes unconscious, to have a lineage that outlives them. One doesn't need to understand the mysticism of Julian of Norwich or delve into the life of Simone Weil to know that inward contemplation sometimes seems to touch transcendent truths. You need not be an artist to know that to a large extent, great art outlives the personal vision of the artist because it speaks not only to our longing for something more eternal in the human condition, but also to our longing for something more eternal in our human aspirations as well. And you don't have to push your physical endurance to the same extremes of our elite athletes to know that in the thrill of life's victories and in the agony of its defeats, we're drawn out of ourselves and words often fail. Transcendence, in its broadest terms, pulls us out of ourselves and connects us to something greater. The recent and mostly meaningless and trivial debates revolving the existence of God do not generally acknowledge that in attempting to connect us to the grand process of evolution, or in their crusade of joining together to rid the world of what they falsely see as the silly superstition of belief, atheists too, in their own way, are looking for some sort of meaning that transcends their individual existence. Either through a carefully crafted desire for it, or simply through living what is considered to be a meaningful life, the vast majority of us are looking for experiences that connect at a deep level to something greater than what we seemingly are. We're looking to rebel against our finitude, looking to find some sort of permanence in a life that we all know is finite and will end. We're really searching for some sort of clue as to the meaning of human existence in the light of our eventual death, to cheat death of its sting. The great poet W.H. Auden walked out one evening thinking that he had found that thing and that love was eternal, until awakened by the clamoring of the clocks in the city that began to whir and chime, singing, "Oh, let not time deceive you, you cannot conquer time." But the deception runs deep. With decaying hands, we grasp and grope for something more eternal, something more permanent. It's the price we pay for housing evolved brains that turn inevitable circumstance into searing existential dilemmas. No other sensible animal would even bother. A few centuries have passed since the philosopher Leibniz first posed the conundrum of why there's something instead of nothing. It's caused a great deal of metaphysical anxiety since then, for both the philosopher and the caffeine-buzzed undergraduate. I won't cause any more anxiety about it here. Well, not much more. But a related question takes us to the heart of our seemingly hardwired longing for transcendence. The problem, really, is the tyranny of time. Alfred Whitehead once noted that all sophisticated philosophies are based upon a simple but unstated idea. As far as I can surmise, the tyranny of time is the one basic and unalterable fact that pervades the very fabric of our existence, And it does so through a relentless assault on our existence in two primary ways. In the first way, time poses a problem because, as we all know, things come from other things. But if that's the case, going back in time long enough causes a problem. Either things came from other things for eternity without any beginning at all, or, even more implausibly, the universe started from nothing, and in the words of Houston Smith, life comes from non-life, sentience from insentience, intelligence from what lacks it. Some philosopher and scientists have devised ingenious ways of thinking that this is indeed the case, but their reasoning always sounds more like rationalizations than it does actual reasons. And our experience of everything always indicates otherwise. In any event, it's a problem that has no easy solution. Leaving that controversy aside, time has a second assault on existence. Every tick of the clock is a tick towards our mortality. A newborn's birth is also their ticket to an eventual death. You might not want to put that on their birthday card, but it doesn't make it any the less true. I'm not being intentionally morbid, but rather just stating the situation in which we find ourselves. It's the context for just about everything else we may do or may think. The real question is, what do we do with this knowledge? What do we do with this limitation? The question is as old as philosophical thought itself. How do we come to terms with acknowledging human limitation without being beset by doubt and powerlessness and depression? Does this knowledge render us powerless to penetrate beyond what we seemingly are? That is, highly evolved animals who are destined to the same dark fate as every other life form? Or do we use this limit as the starting point to transcend our finitude? Or is there something in between these poles? All of this is the long way of saying that we really don't know why humans are here in the first place. Science has been phenomenally successful at telling us the mechanisms by which the universe evolved to the point of making it possible for us to be here, and then the mechanisms necessary to keep us here. But it can't comment on why we're here in the first place. Our ultimate beginnings and our ultimate ends, the arche and telos not only of our lives, but of life itself, remain as hidden mysteries. And so we grope and grasp our way through life, looking for a template. The great Canadian thinker Northrop Frye reminds us, if the poet William Blake didn't do it first, that our model for human life is quite different from other animals. When we crawled out of the primordial slime, moved from our bellies to our feet, and took a look around, we liked what we saw. And ever since, we've developed our specifically human capacities for self-consciousness, creativity, and love, while still sharing the biological necessities of other animals. The physical necessities for warmth, sustenance, and reproduction for humans are very much aligned with other animals. But we aren't simply content to have a shelter. We need a home. We cultivate the natural world to create gardens and farms. We aren't content with roots and berries, but want a cuisine. We need not only sex, but long for love. And freedom is as important to human and humane existence as water and air is to our biological existence. These are specifically human creations, and they're so embedded in us that we usually forget that they are creations, created out of our imagination. The real world for humans is inescapably and irrevocably a world fabricated by and for us. Inescapably bound by nature, but always attempting to create a more human environment, we're faced with the world of nature that's given to us and a world of culture we create for ourselves. And in the ensuing dialectic, we rub up against our finitude. One wouldn't have to look very hard to find examples of the destructive side of our creations. An environment that's now rebelling against years of neglect and abuse, the all-too-frequent outbreaks of genocide, the wars of aggression, the corruption and waste that cause massive starvation and poverty, and our overall penchant for artistic cruelness, as Ivan calls it in The Brothers Karamazov, are just a few examples of stewardship gone awry. The list is really endless. But we didn't botch all of it. In great works of art, Eliot's Four Quartets or Coltrane's A Love Supreme, in the daily sacrifices athletes make in order to master their sport, in the developments of science that uncover the foundational structure of the world around us and the mathematical elegance of the universe, in the struggle for equality and justice and peace, and in the neighborly love we see every day, we show that we're not only capable of artistic cruelness, but also have an abundance of artistic hopefulness in believing that we are capable of more than we know and are always more than we can ever dream. You'll notice that the death impulse really dominates our urge for aggression, corruption, and cruelty. Nihilism is really a form of powerlessness. It's what happens when we let our baser animal instincts rule intellect, will, and emotion. We fill our egos and satisfy our simple animal hungers. You'll also notice that when we don't botch creation, we aren't rendered powerless to transcend our given biological necessities and our fate of life in time, but identify with the genuinely creative and powerful attributes which seek some sort of connection to something greater than ourselves. But it's deceptively simple, and the dangers are always present. When the quest to push the human form to its limit in the pursuit of the faster time, the more perfect dismount, or to break a record is performed dishonestly, the genuinely creative aspects of the sporting endeavor have been violated in favor of egoistic impulses. When scientific claims become standards for truth beyond the realm of its domain and assumes for itself the only privileged authority and control over all aspects of life, then science has been replaced by scientism, knowledge and theory have been erroneously conflated, and the genuine curiosity that underlines the scientific endeavor has become a far too simple, narrow, and oppressive dogma of belief. When the need to belong turns into unbridled nationalistic or ethnic pride that seeks domination over others, belongingness has turned to separation. When atheists and religious believers become irrationally fundamentalist about their beliefs, a wretched and militant dehumanization replaces the quest for meaning. On this last issue, this is the type of thing that's come to dominate a potentially fruitful discussion. The often sloppy historical work, invective polemic, and fallacious reasoning spurred by the so-called new atheists has left in its wake discussions about God and religion that are rather meaningless for thoughtful atheists, religious believers, and those of us who are somewhere in between. This need for transcendence, to belong or connect to something greater, either through other people, a cause, a divinity, or an indifferent process of evolution, remains at the core of our existence. The real difference between atheists and believers is that the former believes that this can be done only through human means, and that beyond space and time there's nothing, while the latter understand this process as needing help from outside humanity, and that beyond space and time there is order and hope that our endeavors here on Earth are connected to a grander and more permanent realm. But there's no guarantees for either proposition. Given the difficulties and our frequent failures, maybe, just maybe, it's not possible in the end to lift ourselves out from the state of nature that seeks to frustrate our creative capacities to turn us into something more than our animal natures. Perhaps, as some have claimed, we only do things out of our selfish, ego-centered desires. The famous Prussian philosopher Immanuel Kant was perhaps more influenced by his Lutheran upbringing than he imagined, as I too perhaps am, when he said that out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing has ever been made. Somewhat along the lines of Nietzsche, though not along the lines of Kant's intention, maybe we should revel in our human, all too human, humanness. In fact, for some, like the philosopher Martha Nussbaum, Molly in Bloom at the end of James Joyce's Ulysses provides the model for love that does not degrade our humanness. These two unromantic and unfaithful characters in bed with the smells of the day lingering upon them provide the model for a sort of love that revels in the human, all too human essences that knows of nothing greater than a celebration of our imperfect finitudes without recourse to anything transcendent. In this way, transcendence must be framed around an acknowledgement that our crooked timbers are always bound to the earth. But even if this is the case, and I'm not sure that it is, but even if it is, Bloom and Molly are still committed to one another and seek companionship. They seek, through the other person, to become more than they are. And they are still, in the words of Auden again, loving their crooked neighbors with their crooked hearts. By now you'll have realized that of course I lied when I said I wouldn't add much to the anxiety that surrounds the question, why is there something instead of nothing? There are no easy answers, and there is a great deal of anxiety. This podcast was meant to be intentionally provocative, one step towards asking some better questions. So in the end, we're back to where we began. Perhaps the question isn't only why the extreme athlete pushed themselves to such extremes, but why we all even bother struggling with making war and making love, making money and helping each other and hurting each other and puffing up our egos, satiating our desires, sharing the abundance with others, keeping too much for ourselves, and sometimes running on empty. What's the point of all of this? And in the words of the writer Annie Dillard, is anyone in charge of this show anyway? Heaven knows. We certainly do not. Like the Olympic athlete, though, we doggedly persist, endeavoring to transcend, to attain some sort of connection to something grander than ourselves, with only a few guidelines from the past to show us the way, no guarantee of success, and only hard work, hope, and the faint, distant promise of future glory.
Intellectual Muscle was developed by Vancouver 2010, UBC Continuing Studies in collaboration with universities across Canada, and the Globe and Mail.